Usually when we look at the world around us, like the massive steel beams holding up skyscrapers or the bridges we drive across every day, or even just heavy machinery on a construction site, there is this this deep-seated expectation of just solid, unyielding permanence.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very human assumption.
Right. I mean, you look at a hunk of forged steel, and to you and me, it just looks like a static, dead block of metal. It really feels like the story of its creation basically ended the exact moment it cooled down in the foundry.
It is entirely counterintuitive to think otherwise, honestly. We perceive these industrial metals as, finished, quiet objects.
Right. They aren't doing anything.
Exactly. There's no visible movement. There's no apparent chemical reaction happening on a macroscopic level. So our brains just automatically classify them as completely inert.
But then, you step into the world of physical metallurgy, and suddenly that whole illusion just shatters. You realize that that piece of steel is actually this frozen
A
battlefield.
very chaotic one, yes.
Right. We are looking at a microscopic landscape that was shaped by, I mean, really chaotic, violent struggles happening in a matter of literally seconds. Every property that makes that steel useful, its strength, its ability to bend without snapping, all of that is the direct result of a hyper-fast structural war that just got locked in time.
That's a great way to put it. It is the absolute definition of a dynamic environment. The metal is effectively this this theater for atomic realignment, and it's driven by extreme heat and physical stress, and then it eventually just freezes in place when the temperature drops low enough.
And that is the exact microscopic theater we are exploring in this deep dive today. So I was going through my stack of sources, and I got completely absorbed by this highly technical 2001 metallurgical study.
Oh, yes, that's a classic one.
Yeah, it's titled Acicular Ferrite Morphologies in a Medium Carbon Microalloyed Steel by researchers Madariaga, Gutierrez, and Padecia. And, what caught my eye wasn't just the really complex terminology, but the fact that these researchers were investigating how a seemingly insignificant temperature shift of just 50 degrees can completely rewrite the internal architecture of steel.
Which is astounding when you consider the extreme baseline temperatures we were dealing with here.
Right, because 50 degrees isn't that much.
Exactly. A 50-degree difference sounds like a rounding error when you were talking about glowing red metal. But on an atomic level, it completely alters the fundamental physics of how the steel solidifies and structures itself.
So for you listening right now, if you've ever wondered how engineers actually manage to get steel to be incredibly strong, yet, flexible enough for massive forging so it can take a heavy impact and bend instead of just shattering into a million pieces,
Yeah.
well, the answer lies right here.
It's all in the microstructure.
Yeah, it all comes down to controlling these microscopic battles in the blink of an eye. So to really understand what Madariaga and his team discovered, we need to introduce the characters in this microscopic world.
Right, we need to set the stage.
Exactly. We are looking at what happens when steel is red hot in a phase called austenite, and then it starts to cool down. And as it cools, the atomic structure basically rearranges, and two main structures can form, which are bainite and acicular ferrite.
And those two structures behave very, very differently, which is why controlling them is so critical. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the entire goal of modern metallurgy for heavy forgings is to maximize toughness.
You want it to be tough, not brittle.
Precisely. You want a structure that actively resists the propagation of cracks.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with bainite. If I had to picture bainite, it's essentially, it's like a neatly stacked deck of cards. It forms in these really highly organized sheaves of parallel plates.
Yeah, that organization is the key defining feature of bainite. So in the cooling austenite, which, just as a reminder, is the hot parent phase of the steel bainite, almost always starts at the edges of the grains.
Them borders, right?
Right. Metallurgists call these the grain boundaries, the bainite nucleates there at the edges, and grows inward from those borders in a very orderly, parallel fashion.
It makes me think of like frost creeping inward from the very edge of a cold window pane.
That's a really good visual, actually.
But then you have acicular ferrite, which is the structure these researchers are hunting for, and it is completely different. Acicular ferrite is more like a chaotic game of microscopic pickup
A
sticks.
chaotic mess, yes.
Right, it forms this interlocking, fine-grained mess. You get these plates just jutting out at all sorts of sharp angles, violently crossing over each other. And it is exactly that chaotic interlocking structure that gives steel such great mechanical property.
It creates physical roadblocks.
Exactly. If a microscopic crack tries to travel through that steel, it has to constantly change direction every single time it hits a new angled plate of acicular ferrite. And doing that absorbs a massive amount of energy and just stops the crack dead.
What's fascinating here is that acicular ferrite doesn't play by the same rules as bainite. Like you said, it doesn't start at the borders. It is entirely an inside job.
An inside job. I love that.
It nucleates intragranularly. So it bypasses the grain boundaries completely and gets its start deep inside the center of the austenite grain.
Which means it needs a starting block, right? I mean, it can't just materialize out of nowhere in the middle of this hot metallic soup.
It definitely needs a seed, yes. It actually looks for tiny non-metallic impurities floating in the steel, which we call inclusions.
Boy, usually in steelmaking, aren't impurities the enemy? Like, they create weak points.
Under normal circumstances, yes. But for acicular ferrite, engineers intentionally utilize these inclusions as launch pads. Yeah. In this specific study, Madariaga and his team noted that the acicular ferrite starts on a highly engineered, very specific type of seed. It's a microscopic sulfide particle with a manganese sulfide, or MnS, core, and that's surrounded by a copper sulfide, or a CuS, shell.
Okay, so you have these tiny core shell manganese and copper seeds just peppered throughout the interior of the steel. And as the temperature drops, the acicular ferrite uses them as an internal starting block to launch its chaotic game of pickup sticks, just building that beautiful interlocking mesh from the inside out.
Exactly.
And that is the ideal outcome. That is what we want for tough, forged steel.
That is the established baseline. Yes, that's the goal. But the researchers wanted to see exactly how this chaos forms, literally second by second, and observe the specific mechanisms that drive it. And that brings us to their experiment, which actually ended up yielding a major anomaly.
Right. So to run this experiment, they took these tiny cubic steel samples. They were just 10 millimeters on a side, and they heated them up to a blistering 1250 degrees Celsius.
Right. They heat these samples to 1250 degrees in an argon atmosphere to achieve full austenitization.
Which makes total sense, because if you left a small steel cube at 1250 degrees in normal room air, I mean, the oxygen would cause it to basically incinerate into scale, right?
Yeah, you'd have nothing left to test. It would just oxidize away.
So they had these pristine glowing cubes of austenite, and then they dropped them into liquid salt baths to rapidly cool them down, which is a process called quenching.
Right, quenching locks in the structure.
And here is the setup they used. They split the samples into two batches. One batch is quenched in a salt bath held at 450 degrees Celsius. And the second batch is quenched in a bath held at 400 degrees Celsius.
A very small difference, relatively speaking.
Yeah. Then they freeze the action at different intervals from just 10 seconds up to 20 minutes so they can use a transmission electron microscope, or a TEM, to look at the atomic structures.
And I just have to say, the TEM is really the unsung hero of this kind of metallurgical research. You know, you can't just look at a solid chunk of metal with a regular optical microscope and see atomic alignment.
Right, you need something way more powerful.
A transmission electron microscope actually requires firing a beam of electrons completely through the sample.
Which raises an immediate physical question for me. How exactly do you slice a 10 millimeter solid steel cube thin enough for an electron beam to pass straight through it? That sounds impossible.
It is an incredibly delicate preparation process. So you have to take that heat-treated steel cube and physically, mechanically grind it down into a thin foil, just fractions of a millimeter thick.
Okay, that sounds tedious.
It is. And then you use a process called electropolishing. You bathe the foil in a chemical solution and run an electric current through it to slowly eat away the metal at the very center. You literally just keep going until a microscopic hole dissolves through the foil.
Wait, really? So you are basically eroding the metal until it just breaches?
Precisely. And right at the very edges of that microscopic hole, the steel tapers off to a thickness of just a few atoms.
Just a few atoms thick. That's wild.
Yeah, and that is where the electron beam can pass through. By looking at how those electrons scatter or diffract when they hit the atomic lattice, metallurgists can map out the exact crystalline structure of the metal.
That level of forensic methodology is just nuts to me. But okay, getting back to the experiment itself. In a furnace running at 1250 degrees, dropping samples into baths at 450 versus 400, I mean, it really feels like splitting hairs. We are talking about a 50 degree difference in an environment that literally melts solid elements. Mm. Is that really going to do anything noticeable to the internal architecture?
It really seems highly improbable that such a small thermal margin would alter the foundational geometry of the steel. But the TEM revealed some incredibly surprising findings here.
What did they see?
Well, when the researchers looked at the samples frozen at the 10-second mark, both the 450-degree batch and the 400-degree batch looked fundamentally identical.
Okay, so at 10 seconds, it's a tie. Nothing different yet.
Yes, exactly, Atai. In both batches, the primary plates of ferrite had successfully nucleated right on those manganese sulfide and copper sulfide inclusions.
The starting blocks worked.
The starting blocks worked perfectly, regardless of the 50-degree difference. But immediately after that 10-second mark, the two batches diverge wildly. In the batch held at 450 degrees, the transformation proceeds exactly how we would expect.
Like the pickup sticks.
Yes. It creates what the researchers categorized as upper acicular ferrite. New ferrite plates start nucleating off the sides of those original primary plates, branching out at sharp angles. It successfully creates that non-parallel chaotic structure we want.
The beautiful mess that stops cracks in their tracks.
Exactly. But the batch held at 400 degrees Celsius creates something called lower acicular ferrite. And here, instead of forming at wild angles, the new plates suddenly form in parallel sheaves.
Wait, parallel?
Yes. They stack up neatly side by side. They perfectly mimic the organized, stacked deck of cards structure of bainite.
But wait, earlier we established that bainite is supposed to form at the edges, at the grain boundaries. You just said acicular ferrite is an inside job.
And that is the absolute crux of the discovery. The 400-degree batch is forming a bainite-like organized structure, but it's doing it from the inside of the grain, growing outward from those central inclusions.
Wow.
Yeah, a mere 50-degree drop completely changed the growth mechanism from chaotic to organized.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this is the mystery of the whole paper.
Okay.
We know what happened, but we really need to know why. Like, why does a 50-degree temperature drop force the steel to suddenly abandon the chaotic angles and just grow in parallel lines?
To understand that, we have to look at the thermodynamics of carbon diffusion. So steel is fundamentally an alloy of iron and carbon. When a new plate of ferrite forms inside that hot austenite soup, the crystalline lattice of the ferrite actually doesn't want the carbon.
It rejects it.
Right. It has a very low solubility for it. So as the ferrite plate grows, it essentially sweeps the carbon out of its way, rejecting it into the surrounding austenite.
Okay, let me try an analogy here to conceptualize this, because visualizing atomic diffusion can be a bit tricky. It's like passengers rushing off a crowded train onto a platform.
Okay, I like where this is going.
Right. So the train is the new ferrite plate forming, and the passengers are the carbon atoms. At 450 degrees Celsius, there's enough thermal energy that the passengers, the carbon atoms, can run away quickly into the surrounding station.
They disperse easily.
Yeah. And because the platform, which is the broad face of the growing ferrite plate, clears out so fast, the space is empty. So new trains, or new plates, can easily pull in and push out of the sides of the original plate at wild, chaotic angles.
That perfectly illustrates the mechanism. At 450 degrees, atomic diffusion is fast enough that the carbon gets completely out of the way. But at 400 degrees Celsius, the system has significantly less thermal energy.
So the passengers are moving slower.
The carbon atoms are sluggish. They can't diffuse away into the surrounding austenite fast enough. So relying on your analogy, you'd get a massive passenger traffic jam right on the platform, right against the broadsides or the faces of the primary ferrite plate.
A microscopic carbon traffic jam.
Exactly. And that carbon traffic jam fundamentally changes the local chemistry of the austenite right next to the plate. A high concentration of carbon makes the austenite highly stable. It effectively armors it.
Oh, I see.
So when the next ferrite plate tries to nucleate on the broad face of the original plate, it hits this impenetrable wall of stabilized carbon-rich austenite and is completely blocked from forming.
So the platform is too crowded, the austenite is stabilized, so no new plate can push out from the side at a chaotic angle. So where does the new plate go then?
It is forced to form at the tips of the primary plates. You see, the carbon is being pushed outward from the broad faces, meaning the carbon concentration at the sharp, growing tips is much lower.
So the tips are unprotected.
Right. The austenite there isn't stabilized yet. By forcing the new plates to form at the tips rather than the faces, they are geometrically constrained. They have no choice but to grow in the exact same direction as the original plate. They grow in parallel, creating those organized sheaves.
That is just mind-blowing. The entire structural geometry of the steel is being dictated simply by how fast the carbon atoms can run away from the forming plates.
It really is. And there is a secondary physical force at play here that the researchers highlight, which locks this parallel growth into place. When a ferrite plate grows inside the solid austenite, it has to physically displace the metal around it.
It has to shove it out of the way.
Right. The researchers refer to this as an invariant plane strain shape deformation.
Invariant plane strain shape deformation. That, That sounds like a serious amount of physical force.
It is an immense amount of localized strain. The parent austenite has a specific atomic lattice, and the new ferret has a different one. As the ferret expands, it warps and distorts the physical lattice of the austenite surrounding it.
So it's creating tension.
Yes, it creates a very specific, intense stress field in the metal. The physics of that stress field actually favor the formation of an identical parallel variant at the tip of the plate, because aligning perfectly parallel minimizes the overall strain energy in the system.
Got it. So it's basically the path of least resistance for the surrounding physical pressure.
Exactly. So at 400 degrees, you are dealing with a thermodynamic double whammy. The carbon traffic jam blocks the sides of the plate chemically, and the mechanical stress field actively encourages the next plate to line up perfectly in parallel at the tip physically.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because if the chaotic interlocking structure we want in steel only happens if the carbon can escape fast enough, what happens to the trapped carbon at 400 degrees? I mean, the carbon doesn't just cease to exist.
No, it definitely doesn't disappear.
Right. If it's caught in this traffic jam between these aggressively forming parallel plates, it has to go somewhere eventually.
It certainly does. And this brings us to a crucial consequence in the microstructure, which is the precipitation of cementite.
Cementite, what is that?
It's iron carbide. At 450 degrees, the carbon escapes so quickly and effectively into the bulk of the austenite that the resulting upper acicular ferrite plates are totally clean. They are carbide free.
Okay, so no cementite there.
Right. But at 400 degrees, because the carbon is trapped locally between and within these parallel growing subunits, the ferrite eventually becomes supersaturated. The crystalline lattice literally cannot hold that much carbon.
So the trapped carbon just, what, forces its way out of the lattice?
Essentially, yes. It drops out of the solid solution. The trapped carbon precipitates and forms cementite, which is a very hard, brittle compound. It precipitates inside the ferrite subunits themselves and also within the thin layers of austenite that got trapped between the parallel platelets.
So you just get these chunks of it everywhere.
You end up with these elongated cementite particles littered throughout the parallel sheaves.
Now, if I am reading this study and I see these claims about carbon traffic jams and intraplatelet precipitation, I just have to ask about the hard proof.
Sure, skepticism is good.
Because if I'm looking at this steel under a microscope, what am I actually seeing that proves this? How do the researchers know for sure that this cementite precipitated from inside the ferrite plates themselves and didn't just, you know, randomly form from generic carbon floating around in the background?
That is where the hard evidence from the transmission electron microscope diffraction patterns comes in. And it is a truly elegant piece of crystallography.
Oh, back to the electron beam.
Exactly. The researchers didn't just look at pictures and guess. They measured the exact angles of the atomic lattices of the ferrite and the cementite. They were looking for specific geometric alignments, which are known in physical metallurgy as orientation relationships.
Okay, so they're measuring the specific angles at which the atoms of the different materials actually meet each other.
Yes. They found undeniable evidence of two specific crystallographic alignments, the Bagarowski orientation relationship and the pitch orientation relationship.
Okay, Bagarowski and pitch. Those sound like incredibly niche geometric principles. If we strip away the heavy jargon, what do these relationships actually mean for the evidence of the experiment?
Think of it like a geometric fingerprint left behind by a microscopic collision. In the Bagarowski relationship, the cementite and the ferrite share a very specific angle of atomic alignment.
Okay.
But the pitch relationship is where the measurements get incredibly precise. The researchers were able to measure specific angles between the atomic planes. They found a 73.5 degree angle between certain planes of the cementite and the ferrite, and a 17.4 degree angle between others.
Wait, 73.5 degrees and 17.4 degrees. That is an absurd level of precision to find in a chaotic hunk of cooling metal.
It has to be that precise. These highly specific angles can only exist if the cementite grew directly out of the atomic lattice of the ferrite and the trapped carbon-enriched austenite.
So it couldn't just happen by accident.
No, if the cementite had just formed randomly from the bulk metal, the angles of intersection would be entirely chaotic and randomized. You would never consistently see 73.5 and 17.4 degrees. Finding these exact angular alignments is the crystallographic smoking gun.
Wow.
It proves absolutely that the cementite precipitated directly because of that localized carbon traffic jam at 400 degrees.
That is just incredible. I mean, they are essentially performing a forensic crash investigation on a microscopic traffic jam that happened in a fraction of a second deep inside a red-hot piece of solid metal just by measuring the skid marks left by the carbon atoms.
It's exactly like reading skid marks. The angles tell the entire story of the velocity and the impact of the elements involved.
So what does this all mean for you? Listen to this. Why did we take you down into the atomic lattice of steel and talk about carbon diffusion and pitch orientation relationships?
It's about understanding the foundation of our world.
Exactly. Because manipulating the microscopic toughness of steel, you know, the material that fundamentally makes up the cranes, the engine blocks, the structural infrastructure of our modern world, it isn't just a matter of tossing some iron and carbon in a massive pot and stirring it up.
Far from it. The chemical recipe is really only the very beginning of the metallurgical process.
It is a hyper-precise, incredibly delicate dance of time and temperature. What this deep dive into Madariaga's research shows us is that a window of just a few seconds and a mere 50-degree thermal shift completely dictate the destiny of the metal.
It changes everything.
It literally decides whether the internal skeleton becomes a chaotic, energy-absorbing mesh that can withstand an earthquake, or an organized parallel stack that behaves entirely differently under stress.
This raises an important question, and I think it's one deeply worth pondering as we move through our built environment. This study shows us that materials have incredibly sensitive, almost invisible tipping points.
Yeah, just 50 degrees.
Right. If a mere 50-degree shift and a 10-second delay can completely alter the fundamental internal architecture of a heavy hunk of forged steel, what invisible thresholds and microscopic battles are happening right now in the everyday objects around you?
Oh, that is a wild thought to walk away with.
Think about the tempered glass protecting your phone screen, or the concrete curing under your feet on the sidewalk, or the aluminum in the chassis of your car. We walk through a world that feels static and finished, but the solid world is far more dynamic and far more delicate than it appears to the naked eye.
It's all frozen chaos.
Every solid object around you is the result of a microscopic battle that was either won or lost in a matter of seconds.
So the next time you look at a massive steel bridge spanning a river, or a towering skyscraper holding its own against the wind, don't just see a quiet, solid object. Look a little closer in your mind's eye. Think about the chaotic game of pickup sticks, the microscopic carbon traffic jams, and the invisible, hard-fought architecture holding it all together. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the physical world around you, because there is always a fascinating battle happening just beneath the surface.